Welcome to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture, brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Tom Lujack. Today we have episode 2 of a 2-part series on consumer behavior. The season of shopping is upon us, and retailers and marketers are bombarding us with messages about purchasing. Even without the effect of the holidays, the average person is exposed to more than 4,500 commercial messages every day. Now, most of those advertisements are easy to ignore, leaving marketers to figure out other ways to get their messages across. So what is it about an ad, whether it's traditional or digital, that stops us in our tracks? And what features of advertising actually lead us to buy? Insights are coming from an ocean of data from shoppers themselves, thanks to digital advertising and social media. The sheer volume of the raw data is so extensive, it boggles the mind. But social scientists are successfully using this sea of information to uncover the secrets of consumer behavior. Our guest today is Purush Papatla, the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute Professor of Marketing in UWM's Lubar School of Business. Welcome, Purush.
Thank you, Tom. It's so good to see you again.
It is. Well, you know, it is that time of season where people are going to be seeing a lot of advertising. So let's first start with social media. How has that changed the advertising landscape?
Well, in the past, advertising used to be, I would say, mostly driven by gut and instinct and intuition rather than data. The arrival of social media that helps marketers gather a lot of data on how people are behaving, what are their preferences, what do they like, what do they not like, has begun to, in fact, I would take the word begun back, has changed that. I mean, today advertising is much more data-driven and it's much more informed. And marketers are able to quite a large extent, predict what consumers would behave like based on the type of ads they put out. So it's a very different world compared to the traditional advertising world.
Well, speaking about different worlds, your world has changed too, because this shift in marketing also meant a shift in your own career, didn't it? Tell us about that.
It did, and I don't want to date myself and tell you when I started. I started a long time ago. But when I started, clearly the social media was still not even a concept that people knew about. The internet was not yet there. But we did have some data coming in, and the data, to use an overused word, but definitely an apt word here, the data revolution in marketing was beginning at the time. And the way it began was by companies like AC Nielsen and other similar companies that started collecting data digitally on people walking in and out of grocery stores. And the way they did that is through something that we all knew about and we continue to use today, the loyalty card, that has grown into so many other sectors. So the idea was that if you enrolled in a loyalty program of a grocery store, you would get a card. It had an identifier. And whenever you checked out, if you gave the loyalty card in return, you would get some incentives. But behind the scenes, whenever the loyalty card was scanned, the store was also able to keep track of what you bought, how much you paid, whether you bought the same brands. So we started kind of mining through the data in those days to understand what people were like. Were they loyal to brands? Were they driven by price? How effective were coupons? So that's the extent to which we got, but that was the start of the data revolution in marketing.
But there was still a lot of data there.
There was still a lot of data, but I would say compared to the data that we are getting now, I would not even be able to put that in context, because the data that we are getting today is literally probably billions of times more than the... this is not an overstatement, it is a true statement. It's billions of times more than the data that we used to have in those days. So there's you talked about an ocean of data. I would call it oceans of data. It's just so much data that I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface. There's so much more to do.
Now, your own background, you actually trained originally as an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you make that shift from an engineer working presumably on building projects, to now an expert in consumer marketing, where your raw ingredients aren't steel or wood, but information, data bits.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I actually started as a mechanical engineer building cars. So I worked in a truck manufacturer as a design engineer. But then I felt as I was working in the company that I didn't have the ability to create and explore, because the designs were set. There's very little room for you to explore and innovate. So I always wanted to innovate, and clearly marketing seemed to be the direction to go in. So I kind of decided that that's the way I want to go. But given my quantitative background in engineering, I also was very interested in using data in marketing. And so as I was doing my master's in engineering, I got really interested in the use of statistics. And as I learned more about statistics and got much better at computer programming, I then realized that a blend of the two can really help me understand and analyze data, and that could be used in marketing. So my PhD dissertation in those days was one of the early ones that used a lot of data from these loyalty cards to develop insights into consumer behavior.
Wow. So you were really at the vanguard, at the front end. Sure. Of using data analysis to help companies,
yes,
organizations sell more product.
Yeah. And in those days, that was the vanguard, and it really set off a revolution. Not my thesis, but a lot of people around the country were working using data in marketing.
Well, you know, much of the advertising that we see or hear, as I mentioned at the beginning, can be tuned out. I mean, if you're looking at thousands of ad impressions each day, you can't possibly absorb all of them. And an ad only will influence those who do pay attention. So what works?
That's one more great question. So you really hit the nail on the head, so to speak. Gone are the days when you could invent a better mousetrap as a product and assume that consumers are going to buy if you are able to get the message to them, because now we are at a point where even getting the message to the consumer and having the consumer listen to the message, process it, and then want to kind of even think about you, forget about buying your product, even think about you is a challenge, purely because of the fact that, as you mentioned at the start, we are being bombarded by thousands of images around us every day. So we are at a point where even the messages and ads themselves have to be very unique, innovative, and creative. Essentially, advertising has to become entertainment because, you know, we all enjoy entertainment. We all enjoy something different. So the way to grab a consumer's attention is to make it so unique and so entertaining that he or she would want to process that, or reach a consumer at a time when that consumer is looking for a product and present the message on that product that that consumer is at that moment interested in. So you can do both because of data today. Understand how to be more unique and understand what message to present to who, when. So both of these are possible today in advertising.
So it sounds like the advertisers really have to be tapped into the culture, into entertainment, into music, into movies, because that is the form of entertainment we're most exposed to. Do they incorporate the same techniques that a movie maker or a musician might have?
They have begun to, but not to the extent that they could or should, because the movie making business has been around for a long time, and producers and directors and musicians know what works at least in the movie world. We don't know that yet in the advertising world. So, you know, what kind of emotions work in an ad? What kind of music works in an ad? What kind of dialogue works in an ad? What kind of people should be presented in an ad? What kind of setting should be shown in an ad? There are so many elements of a visual, be it a static image or a video, that you really need to peel an enormous onion layer by layer back to understand what makes a visual or a video work. It's a very complex process, but the work has begun. But it's going to take some time for us to get there.
We're going to come back and talk more about that production process in a moment. But let me first ask you about consumer psychology. How does what's going on in the head of that consumer influence the effectiveness of an ad? I mean, are the people sure. who are creating the ads really studying people as a psychologist would?
Well, I mean, as I said, there are two means of reaching a consumer and getting the message processed, your message processed. So getting to the right consumer at the right time with the right message, right? So if you're thinking about buying a product, you need it now. If a marketer were to present a message exactly related to that product at that moment, you're more likely to pay attention because you need the product. You're thinking about it. So there is data that can help you do that. And as an example, if you type in something on Google as a search phrase, right away you're telling the world that that's you're interested at that moment. So if you type in, you know, Airbnb in Hawaii, Airbnb knows that you're looking for locations to stay at. Hawaiians know that you're trying to travel to Hawaii. Airlines know that you're trying to travel to Hawaii. So you've told so many different entities in the world what you're thinking about at that moment. And Google, to the extent that it can take that search phrase and trigger ads related to all of those different products and services and present to them, is able to reach you at the right time. So that's one way to do that. Let's take an alternative case where you didn't type in Hawaii, you're looking for something else. But based on what Google or the search engine that you're using knows about you and your demographics and who you are, your past search patterns, at that moment they can infer that maybe you are at a point where you might be thinking of taking a vacation. And you're also someone who has expressed an interest in Hawaii in the past. So they can then start presenting messages related to Hawaii, even though at that moment you're not thinking about it. So that's one way to capture the right consumer at the right time. But in addition to that, let's extend that logic a little more, right? If you're an airline that is that's able to fly people to Hawaii, you can expect that there's going to be five other airlines that can do the same thing. So all six airlines are competing for your dollar to go to Hawaii, right? So each of those has to differentiate itself in the same Google page to make sure that you look at their ad rather than the other five ads. Right? Because all six are going to come up. All six are trying to reach you. How do they do that? By making their ads so unique and so different that you say, that's interesting. Let me look at that. So that's where creativity and understanding what clicks with a consumer or with consumers in general in terms of the content you present to them is important.
It's mind-boggling to think of all the calculations that are going on in the background
yes.
by these competitors all trying to yes. get their product or service in yes. front of you. Are you surprised that the computer systems that we have in this world can support that? I mean, that seems to me like an overwhelming task.
No, I'm not surprised given the amount of computing power that's available with these big giants like Google and Amazon and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and so on. I'll throw in one more stat for you. So when you're looking at a Google search page, for an advertiser to decide whether or not to present its ad to you and pay for your eyes, your time to Google, they have to know whether it's worth their investment. So Google and there are a lot of background companies that are called ad agencies, digital ad agencies, and advertising platforms. They're actually taking the literally bids from different advertisers to present an ad to you from around the world. And they're processing all of that information in 0.36 of a second and then deciding whose ad to present to you where on the page. So that's how much computing power we have today.
So when I was looking for that vacuum cleaner, true story, online last week, and I went to a couple of places. I went to Costco and to Target and, you know, what do they have out there? Well, for the next 4 days, you would think we had a very dirty house. I was a little embarrassed because they were all saying, you know, you really need a vacuum cleaner.
Right.
But I was amazed at how quickly those ads were served up. And each one looked different, too.
Yes, yes. And that's all called, in the digital advertising world, it's called retargeting. So retargeting relates to the idea that once you expressed an interest in something by searching for it, from that moment on, they are going to keep tracking you wherever you go and presenting ads to you at whatever site you are in. And this is all part of that advertising network that I mentioned earlier.
Amazing. Amazing. This is Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Tom Lujack, and today we have episode 2 of a 2-part series that's looking at consumer behavior. Our guest is Purush Papatla, the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute Professor of Marketing in the Lubar School of Business at UWM. Purush, I want to come back and talk a little bit more about how these ads are constructed. Give me a sense of what should they be featuring if they're going to be successful? Is it showing a person using the product? Is it just showing the product? Is it showing the solution to the problem that you're buying this product or service for? What has your research shown in terms of the best way to construct an ad, especially in the digital world?
Sure. And so let's talk about what we mean by an ad before we dig into that question. So an ad could be static, like a picture, like the traditional print ad being presented to you online, or an ad could be a traditional video ad like what you would see on a television program. And what you include in each of these is very different because of the amount of content that each can have and the amount of information you can convey. So let's start with the static ads, the images, right? So if it's an image where it's like a print ad, but it's digital, you're showing a product, what are the different elements of that image that you should think about in order to capture the viewer's attention? So most of the thinking and research into constructing the quote-unquote optimal ad surprisingly relates to how we humans evolved going back millions of years. Because the way we actually evolved actually hardwired our bodies to respond to certain things. So what do we mean by that? So if you think about the most critical component of any picture, color, we all respond to colors, and research into color theory dates more than 100 years, and we all are looking for certain colors. Some colors appeal to us and some colors turn us away. So what our research has shown, working with literally millions of pictures and consumer response to them, is that a combination of the hues of blue and green drop people into the picture and make them want to spend time with it. A dominance of red, on the other hand, excites people. They kind of are drawn to the picture, but they're also, without realizing, are repelled by the picture because red kind of brings up some associations with difficult situations. So what is the bottom line then? You want to increase the combinations of greens and blues in your print ads, in your digital images. You want to cut back on red, although you don't want to eliminate that because red does attract people, right? So you want to have a mix of green and blue and some tone of red to draw that attention. Let's extend that. What should be in the picture? In addition to the colors, you're showing the product, you're showing people. Once again, what our research shows, going back literally to millions of years of human evolution, is that, and this is literally built on a theory in anthropology that looked at how we evolved as humans. When we evolved as humans, when we didn't know much about the world, apparently we developed an instinct to look at another human that we ran into and assess that human's intent towards us because of things like cannibalism and because people didn't know, we didn't know what the other person was like.
You size them up.
You size them up, exactly. Yeah. And the best way to size them up is by looking at their face and assess their intentions. So that became such an integral part of our DNA that actually a part of our brain evolved, and that part of the brain is dedicated to processing faces. Which means that if an ad has a face, and the face is looking at you, and the ad is for a product, as people, given our DNA, we're going to be drawn more to the face and first to the face rather than the product. Now, extend that logic a little more. Online, people don't spend more than 2 or 3 seconds for any visual content, any picture. So if in those 2 seconds, you spend 1.5 seconds on a face in the ad, you're left with only 0.5 seconds for the product, you're not paying attention to the product and you move on to the next picture. So what does that mean? If you're advertising products, you want to show people, but you don't want to show their faces dominantly in the picture. You want to include them, but you want to cut back on how much you show them in the picture. Because if you don't include them at all, people are not going to be interested in the product too, because they don't understand the context of the product. So if you have to include them, but don't include them in a big way. So that's one example takeaway from this research.
That's amazing. What about sound? What about ads that have music or some other sound effect? Does that have a major influence on whether
absolutely,
or not?
Absolutely. So you might have realized or noticed that when you have a TV program on and there's a commercial break, suddenly the volume of the TV goes up, right?
Yeah, you suddenly think you're either they're pushing it or your hearing suddenly got better,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And that's done on purpose because a long time ago, marketers realized that one way to grab your attention is to make you suddenly kind of jerk up because of something unexpected. And the only thing unexpected that they had in their control was sound, nothing else. So one way to increase your attention to an ad on TV was to increase the sound relative to the program itself. The problem became so big that regulators stepped in, literally the Congress stepped in and passed an act called the CALM Act. And the CALM Act regulated ads to have no more volume than the rest of the program. So they cannot increase the volume to too high a level now.
Wow.
So we now looked at that question and we said, what can we do to kind of address this issue to somehow give some control back to advertisers to make them have audiences view the ads with more attention? So we did a lot of research working with a company that tracks viewer behavior on about 19 million TVs every day. And we analyzed the response of people in terms of whether they're watching ads fully or stopping them as soon as the ad comes for about 27,000 ads shown nationally about a million times in all about 3 trillion viewings of the ads. So we mined through the data to understand what kind of audio the ads should include, not just music, audio. And what our findings show is that ads that have higher audio energy are those that are going to attract people's attention, make them sit through the ad longer time. So what do we mean by energy? This is a concept that we borrowed from the well-known music streaming service Spotify. They, I'm sure you know that Spotify recommends songs to you.
Yeah.
They're able to recommend songs to you by understanding, by looking at your past patterns and tell you what kind of songs you like. And one of the attributes of music that they use is called energy. And so we kind of borrowed that concept, but they don't tell us what energy is. We reverse engineered that using about 1.5 million other songs to construct what that energy is. And then we took it back to these ads, stripped out the audio from those ads, understood what this energy meant in those ads, and correlated that with the viewing patterns. And that's how we came up with this finding.
Wow, that is amazing. You know, I know a lot of people who have worked or still do work in the advertising business. And, you know, I've talked to creative directors who have, in trying to sell their idea to me when I was working both at the university and in my other jobs in the past where we were selling services, creative service director would say, trust me, it's got the energy. It feels right. But what you're saying is one person's personal feeling is pointless if it doesn't match up with what the research shows people really respond to, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, what we actually incorporated in this research was another finding from a different research that was done by someone. What that research showed by analyzing about 150 million streaming sessions on Spotify was that there were temporal patterns during the day in how much energy people want in music. So there are certain times they want high energy, there are certain times they want low energy. So we borrowed that finding and we used that finding in our research as well to come up with insights into at what time of the day that an ad is shown at should imply for what energy it should have. So if it's shown at a certain time during the evening after prime time, the energy level should be lower. If it's shown during the prime time, it should be higher. If it's shown during a different part of the day, it should be higher and so on. So we're able to also map how much audio energy an ad should have in order to relate better to the audiences that are watching the ad.
So from a production standpoint, somebody producing a commercial has to be prepared to do multiple versions.
Absolutely.
Or know that it can only air at one time versus another.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow, that's crazy. Not crazy. It's crazy amazing that you've been able to do these calculations to come up with that. We have just a little bit of time left, and I really want to ask you this question because the holiday season is coming up. Does consumer behavior d- differ during a holiday season versus the rest of the year? Do advertisers have to do anything special because it's November, December?
Yeah, advertisers actually have a very positive environment, but also a very difficult environment in the holidays. Let's start with the positive aspect, right? Everyone is looking to shop and to buy. So consumers, you and I, are going to be less concerned about price and more concerned about finding the right product and the right gift. So that's the time when most of the selling happens. And in fact, most of the revenues and profits are made. So it's a good time for sellers, right? On the other hand, it's also a tough time because just like brand A is trying to sell to you, brands B, C, D, and D are also trying to sell to you. So everyone is after your dollar. You have only so many dollars to spend. So A, B, C, D, and D have to figure out a way to differentiate themselves to the ads they show you, to the product they present to you. So it's a very good time, but it's also a very tough time for marketers during holidays.
So marketers then not only have to figure out what components work best for their particular product, but they're looking over their shoulder at the competitors to see whether they're doing anything different or special that maybe they should copy, huh?
Absolutely. So you can't just be happy copying products. You have to be thinking about copying ad ideas as well. And that's what is happening today.
So one last question. Is there too much data out there? Are we ever going to be overwhelmed, or do you welcome even more data to increase your ability to do this analysis?
I would welcome more data because it's really, I think, an amazing and fascinating time to be a researcher today, because we have an unparalleled and unprecedented ability to understand us, human behavior. What drives us? What is it that we don't like? And I think in a way, in the end, this analysis, if used right, can benefit everyone, because marketers and sellers are going to be able to give people what they want and avoid going after people with things that they don't want. So in a way, there's a lot of good that's going to be coming out of these vast amounts of data.
Thank you so much, Purush. Just a fascinating conversation. Purush Papatla, Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute Professor of Marketing at UWM. That's today's show. Thanks for listening. Curious Campus is produced by Genera Armas and Laura Otto. Our engineer is Jason Reavy, and I'm your host, Tom Lujack. If you enjoyed our show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast app.